Hey everybody, I'm Chris.
Hey, I'm Bill.
Have you ever asked yourself, what is your superpower?
Everyone has a superpower. Most people just don't know what it is.
We're going to help you uncover it.
This podcast is all about helping people figure out what their truly unique superpower is.
Superpowers, what's yours?
Hello and welcome to another Superpowers podcast. We are excited. We have an incredible guest. Chris, give us a little background on who we got today.
Bill, good to be back with you. We had a few week hiatus and interesting and trying times, which I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about today. So we have Howard Lindzen, everyone. So Howard can't wait to get into his story. He's Canadian. He's an author. He's a writer. He has been involved in angel investing. He's a startup founder, heavily involved in the fintech space, which we'll get into his fund. He's been involved with a lot of exciting companies, including Social Leverage, a company he started, StockTwits, which he sold and bought back, Robinhood, Wag, Golfer, friends with Fred Wilson, which is a great friend to have, but all around, in my humble opinion, a very well-liked, funny, charismatic individual, and we could not be happier to have him on the Superpowers podcast show. Welcome, Howard.
Well, you forgot handsome.
Well, I didn't actually forget it. If I felt it, I would have said it.
I mean, Josh Felser would have made you say handsome.
Josh Felser would have made me say handsome. I'm going to go pretty urban cool, though, with that kind of non-startup founder hoodie and the trucker hat that you probably stole from your kid's closet.
So that hat is, I was in Aspen, and it had, I love popcorn. My logo kind of looks like this because my name's Howard, and it has an H. So I think it's some skiing brand. I bought a lot of hats that had this logo.
You got your hats. Howard, I want to just ask you about that dude over your left shoulder, or what's going on. It looks like a drunk elf.
No, it's a guy playing golf.
There's the Bob Hope.
That's the same thing, Bill.
That is Robin Hood. So when Robin Hood raised their A round, we had done a lot of work in their seed investors, and they all signed a photograph of, I don't know who that, Friar Tuck or somebody else, and they sent me a nice framed thing. And I'm never in this office, so hopefully the sound's okay. This is my San Diego home, Coronado home, and offices don't need anything except a laptop, you know.
Yeah, what is
office? Bizarre. Like, what is office? So this like has an it's the nicest office that's never ever needed of all time.
Well, that's a good segue into your, I know your home base is Coronado, San Diego. Uh-huh. Let's just start off, Howard. Where have you been in the last kind of 90 days? Talk to us a little bit about where you've been geographically and your family we're in some cases coming out of a crazy quarantine, depending on who you ask, but where are you and how have you guys been? What's been sort of the crazy and the good, coming out of the big Q?
So we're taxes and college and whatever, Phoenix. You know, I lived in Phoenix for about 30 years. Went to ASU and Thunderbird. We've been locked down in Phoenix, which was a good place originally for the lockdown. They say the curve is going bananas in Phoenix right now. So I guess heat doesn't kill the virus, according to Phoenix. So we were hunkered down, avoiding misinformation and doing the responsible, what we thought was responsible thing, is social distancing and just, you know, risking divorce by being in the same house together after 24 years. So we think we did our part. You know, if you go into my search, there's a lot of searches for divorce attorneys, I think. I think if you went into everybody's search, it'd be like porn would come number two at this point in the crisis.
How many people do you think are like, wow, you know, I'm spending all this time with my wife. She's actually kind of cool.
Nobody. Literally nobody. Okay, that hopefully cut that out. Edit that out.
Yeah, we'll edit that.
I thought this was a show where you can't lie.
Go ahead, Howard.
I really think porn is now number two search thing over divorce attorneys. So, and we invested in a legal startup during the crisis. So like our first check during COVID is to a legal startup. And divorce is part of their thing. So, you know, we'll get a deal at least if this happens. So we were locked down. My daughter, I was at U of A. My son has his own, he's working, he's a one bedroom. So he wasn't necessarily, I wouldn't say behaving, but he has like a weird, you know, Gen Z has their own thing going on, even if it's a group. And that, you know, as long as he wasn't killing old people, we were cool with it. And so we were in Phoenix. It was beautiful. Luckily, we have a small place. It's in the desert up on the hill, and it was safe. The heat, it gets to about 175 degrees Celsius in Phoenix in June, yeah. July. And that's global warming. It used to be only 160 degrees Celsius. And we go to Coronado. Jews in Phoenix, that's our Florida. Like, you know, just like New York goes to Florida, the Jewish people,
yeah.
Just go to Coronado. So it's like a weird migration pattern. And so that's where we spend our summers. The kids grew up here. They went to public school here on the island, Coronado. It's a Navy base. I'm not a Navy SEAL. Hopefully you guys, you know, I think it's hard to differentiate between a venture capitalist freak and a Navy SEAL, but I'm not a Navy SEAL. So just
we actually wanted to get into your military training and military background on this.
Yeah, I'll show you my pecs.
Well, shirts off at some stage during the show. And Howard,
shirts
as
off,
you know,
viewership down. That's our logo. That's our tagline.
Bill, Howard, as you know, you have willingly agreed and signed off to join the Superpowers podcast on our show. With my wonderful host, Bill, we cover everyone's unique superpowers. And it's Bill and I's responsibility to tell you what your superpower is at the end of the show as we get to know you and our guests get to know you a little bit better. So that's the journey we're on for the next whatever minutes it takes to hear a little bit about your background and where you're from. And I think that's a good starting off point, Howard. Talk to us a little bit about your childhood and where you grew up. I actually don't know that, but tell us about little Howard, upbringing, your family, your siblings, anyone that still likes you or speaks to you.
The reason I live in San Diego is because my family's in Toronto. There you go. That pretty much saved you an hour.
check next.
Hello. I mean, that was easy. Let's do another episode one day.
Next one.
my superpower is running away. my wife's superpower is staying.
Your wife's superpower is making sure you
her therapist's superpower is she doesn't run fast enough. I mean, I grew up in Toronto, a normal, idiotic Jewish kid. Upper middle class, very anxious.
Now, how many Jews are in Toronto? Is it big population?
I would say maybe next to the Jewish population in Toronto is very conservative. It's a fantastic Jewish, large, as it's a very bigly Jewish population. We're the most Jewish of the Jews. We love our Jews. It's bigly. It's going to be wonderful. We have, I would say maybe other than LA and New York, maybe tied with Chicago, like the largest Jewish population in the world.
Wow.
And maybe 100,000 or so. So it's still 1 degree of separation. You know, Moshe, still 1 degree of separation. He owes me money. And so it's like 1 degree. Grew up, I think, in a very anxious environment, which created this beast. So it's kind of like Larry David meets venture capital. That's kind of
What was the anxious environment that what caused the anxiety? What did you live with other people?
A very large nose and a bad hairline. I think that would cause anxiety.
That's fair. Yeah.
Yeah. And a mole.
Howard, what would you like?
I mean, that's a cocktail for anxiety. Oh, and then throw in my mom who's nuts.
like us all. Go ahead, Bill.
I'm picturing his parents like in a Seinfeld episode or something like
that. Nah, listen, I wish my parents were like Costanza's parents. That would be normal.
Yeah, that would be normal.
Mine were his parents, but like a little bit meaner and much wealthier and a lot more guilt. But so I love my childhood. My therapist says that she thinks it was a terrible childhood. I thought it was normal.
By the way,
I
think we should dial his therapist and his wife's therapist right in.
Right?
Yeah. Can't afford
patch
it.
Him
can't
in. Afford Hannah, go patch him in.
Can't afford it.
So, Howard, what were you like as a child, and do you have brothers and sisters?
Two sisters. They're great. Smart enough not to talk to me for the last 25 years. No, I'm kidding. So they're great. I had no dogs. Dogs are cooties, so I had a very normal childhood. Dogs carry disease. Who knew it would be COVID?
Yeah.
So I didn't get a dog. Now we have dogs. Anything that we couldn't do as a kid in Toronto, I do now.
Where do you fall in the order of your two sisters?
Oh, I'm in the middle.
Chris,
I know.
How many middle children have we had on?
Oh, is there something there? Is there something there?
That's the part of it.
I have a philosophy that middle children are always trying to prove something. Because, like, you know, you're not the baby. You know, the number one always gets all the attention. The middle child always has to fight for everything. And a lot of successful people are middle children.
I think I was the favorite one by my mom. But yep. I think there was that, like, you know that disease where they make up diseases about their kid to keep them trapped up?
Yep.
You had that.
Not the one where they kill you, the other version of it. But I think that I was a victim of that. But I can't prove it.
Where do your sisters
live?
Got
her on the podcast. We could confront her.
Where do your sisters live and what do they do?
My sister Fern in Toronto is a successful party planner, although post COVID it's like, I don't think there's a job.
Not as successful.
Yeah. And then my other sister is in Florida and she's just raised three great kids. They have all raised three great kids and we've raised a couple great kids.
So she made it to Del Boca Vista.
She's Del Boca Vista. And you never call, and they have a lot of mothballs and a lot of hurricanes. No, she's doing good. Her son went to school in Florida, and her two daughters are in Toronto, very successful. So it's like, it's a really close family other than we don't talk. It's who knows what's normal. It's a normal in the sense that we haven't killed one another. There's no Cain and Abel story yet.
Right. And Howard, what last question on the child? What did your parents do?
So my dad was a securities attorney, but more of like a stock guy, like a promoter. Yep. Back in the day, Vancouver and Toronto was like little shade of Reno, but a really smart, successful securities attorney. And then my mom was a housewife.
So you would have observed a lot of the grind and hard work of raising three kids, two of them semi normal, and then you. So I imagine I was raised by
Jamaican and Filipino people, which may explain some of this stuff, and also in a world where they would cut the crust off my bread because I didn't like crust. So it's a little bit like Richie Rich meets Psycho meets Jughead.
What was your childhood thing? Were you a peanut butter and jelly with the cut off, or were you a mac and cheese guy?
Totally.
Or like hot dog with nothing? I bet you never had any condiments on any of your food as a kid. Am I right?
That's such a great question, by the way, because I was just talking to one of my best buddies in Toronto. I have such great, friends in Toronto. I think if you're going to say my superpower is, I just am so lucky at the friends that I have. Whether I create them or whatever. So I can still talk to my five-year-old friends in Toronto and we just know so much about each other. You don't have to see each other. So I get these random calls. Now that we're 54 and our kids are out of the house, we get to like hang out again, like via all these
communication
products. Yeah. And it's just like, fuck, it's just no one cares what you do for a living. No one gives a shit about like how many fucking divorces you've had and no one gives a shit about your hairline. Well, we give a shit about hairlines because we compare.
The good friends don't judge you. So
I was saying that like with condiments, I was a no condiment person. No lettuce or tomatoes or onions or pickles. Ugh, mayonnaise. Yeah. I like a little bit of mustard, a little bit of ketchup. And then I had friends that would go to McDonald's and actually bring their own ketchup and mustard. So there was that psychoticness Jewish thing going always at one end or the other. But I've been blessed with like the best friends, and whether I created that or just the environment was conducive to that.
Well, they probably felt sorry for you. So probably a lot of the friends that you've met just feel this empathy. And
new ones do. The old ones don't know. The old ones don't know.
That's all.
Now they just want a piece of the Howie.
Howie, what was Bill? Let's shift into Howie for the rest of the show, if you don't mind. Howie, what was from a Canadian being born in? Do you talk about being born in Canada and what are your advantages? Like, I mean, I've never really heard you mention that. Like,
no advantages. If I say mom or out, someone goes, hey, Canada. But I don't think there is any advantages to being from Canada. I love America. I think America is doing a bad job of being proud of America. It's all fake, fake proud. Whereas Canadians are unproud. It's a really weird dichotomy, right? Like, we could take over Canada. Like, America should just slip in there with a couple of donuts and some Ambien, and it's like 2 weeks.
We're here.
2 weeks skirmish in Buffalo, and it's ours. And so it's like we have a whole fake Canadian relationship. It's one country. It's just America's very busy and hasn't dealt with Canada yet. And so I moved. I'm like, fuck, I want to be on the winning team. How idiotic is Canada? Like, what are we waiting for? I don't even think Canada should be a country at this point. It's just a, it's better than Ohio. I would just say it's like a 58th state or how many states. Ask Trump how many states there are. Add one for Canada and name it Ontario. And let's just sell off, you know, Alabama and Ohio. And we'll keep Florida because it theoretically it may come in handy one day.
First of all, he wouldn't be able to answer that question, but move it on.
Oh, what was the question?
No, he wouldn't be able to answer the question.
Yeah, he's talking about Trump. Trump was talking about buying like Iceland or something at some point. So
that's the thing. It's like Canada's right there. Yeah, why argument. And he's got to go to Iceland. Like, if this
gonna,
is why I don't like the guy.
If you're going to buy a 51st state, exactly. It should be Canada over
because Iceland. He wants to start an airline to fly over the ocean that will fail. So not only do we have to fly far, he wants to have the airline instead of just driving a truck over the border from Buffalo. He's just an idiot.
So were you into hockey as a Canadian? I feel like that, like every Canadian loves hockey.
Yeah, I wasn't a good skater, but I loved hockey. I you know, if I could skate, that's what I'd be doing. But I'm Jewish. You can't skate. My mom would be in a fur coat yelling at somebody that hit me when I was 8 years old. Like, that's anxiety right there. It's like, I thought it was a bear. It's my mom. Because, you know, before the internet, everybody was a furrier or ran a deli in Canada. Or drove a bus. That was it. Hey, dad's a climber. He's driving a bus. He's got the good line up Bathurst Street. By the way,
hey, Bill, are we on his show or is he on ours? I'm still trying to figure this out.
I have no idea. I have no idea.
I mean, we're friends, aren't we? Are we caping?
I feel like this is. I actually do feel like I'm on like an episode of Seinfeld. I feel like we're gonna talk for 2 hours about nothing.
That's venture capital.
Yeah.
Now you have my superpowers. Let's do a deal.
Howard, what did you
do? The founder.
Howard, what did you do? Did you do anything interesting as a kid? Side hustle? Did you use any of those? What did you do? I bet there's people looking for you still. Like, I feel like you owe people money.
They're looking for my dad. That's what's so funny. I think no one's looking for me because they're busy looking for my dad. And I say that half jokingly. He had a bit of a dark past. No murders that we know of. There was no CSI. There was no DNA testing back then. So he's one step ahead of everybody. So the biggest thing that I ever did was I was like crazy. You know, I had it. Like I said, I was very spoiled in a way financially. So TV, Mattel, and
wait, and it's just for viewers in other parts of the country that don't know what that means. So you grew up rich. Your family's super.
You don't know
wealthy.
That when you're a kid, right? You don't know what your parents do. You just are born into, you know, you're born in Toronto at my decade, no wars, Jewish, you know, upper middle class. You just are. You don't have any choice. That's just luck. And right. or not luck, but I feel lucky and grateful. So the anxiety is not something you control. You just flee from it, or you survive, right? That was my basic instinct that I guess I had. And you try and keep your sanity. But my thing was comedy, right? Like Toronto was, when I was growing up, it was Mike Myers, Jim Carrey, 14 years old, sneaking into comedy clubs. Toronto was the place, Second City. You had Second City Television with John Candy and Eugene Levy. Those are the funniest people of all time. All time, right?
Did we lose Howard? This is weird. Did we lose Howard? Did I lose you, Chris?
Wait, let me see if I can trick you. Did I not warn you about this one, Bill?
But by the way, there's part of me that thinks that it's not an inner connection right here. He's just doing it. But potentially.
So this is an opportunity for us to talk openly. I think he's a complete dick. And I wanted him on the show for his Twitter follower base to help kind of rise the profile of superpowers. Howard's never anyone that I liked or respected. I want to make that clear, Bill. And well, now, I know we'll probably edit this.
He was pausing and now he hung up on you. Oh, all right, man. let's give a little time for him to call back. That was funny.
You okay? Did the dogs get you? I mean, Bill, 15 minutes in and the guy's already made 20 jokes at a comedy club would have worked.
Hello, sorry guys.
It's okay.
So Howard, it was really funny because you were talking and all of a sudden you froze. And I was like, did he actually freeze or is he fucking with us? And then Chris started disparaging
I'm not good you. Enough at technology. I'm not good enough technology to fuck with you.
And then Chris Another started disparaging you.
I don't know how to use anything, which is a fucking plus in this industry.
See, by the way, this is where you realize like how someone's assistant who does everything for them, like, you know, like I like my tea a certain way and like I just can't do it the same way.
No one would work with me. I have no assistants. I have no tricks. I don't know how to use the internet. Something just happened and everything went dark. I thought we were nuked on my end. I thought the Koreans came for us. Like I am living in a place where North Korea, we go first or last with muskies on the bridge, right? Like we're lit up. We're Navy SEALs. We killed fucking Bin Laden in this place. So we're first on the list. That could have been it. You might have seen it. When we went flat there, that might have been a nuclear war.
So I don't know why, but like I kind of have a feeling, like I have this visualization of your mom, and I could be totally off. But
no, we may have to edit this part out. Carry on.
I'm visualizing like an overprotective Jewish Canadian mom in like a beautiful long fur coat. Basically,
with a fufu, with a smock underneath. She never prepared anything underneath that. Though.
So
she got everything right except there was nothing underneath. Except like
just the fur coat. And then because she's got two daughters, like Howard was her precious, child, right?
I do no wrong. I could get away with fucking.
And I could just imagine
murder.
Her just like on the side, like just being like, Howie, no, don't do that. You're gonna get hurt.
You're gonna get hurt, Howie.
There was two choices. I could have been two things, Dahmer or a venture capitalist.
So Howard, where you were before
I chose venture capitalist. I would think it was a good choice out of the two.
So Howard, before you cut out.
I have no freezers. If you go into my garage, I don't have one freezer.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the authorities are
I ran. When I saw Dahmer, I'm going, wow, I did pretty good. Like I told my therapist when I saw the Dahmer stuff, I go, this could have been me.
By the way, Jeffrey Dahmer. It's funny you mentioned of all the serial killers, you have to mention Jeffrey Dahmer.
I don't know them all.
I grew up 19 blocks from him.
So yeah. Howard, Bill collects.
That'll be on my podcast.
So Howard, some people
whose collect, podcast is this? Who are you even, by the way?
Howard, some people collect baseball cards, and Bill has sort of this whole running list of all the serial killers. He's
Well, that show on Netflix was fantastic.
It's great. Great
So Howard, you were basically admitting that you never worked while you were in Canada.
No, sorry. So I worked like an animal. I just had the bug to be an entrepreneur, and there's no internet, so I was like car washing, window washing, whatever.
Talk to us about your entrepreneur stories. What did you build and all that?
Well, there was nothing to build, right? I was a kid, but I had like when my parents would go to New Mexico, I would buy like turquoise stuff and sell it to my dad's friends, like rings and jewelry, because we were the only Jews going to New Mexico. Like I thought I'd discovered turquoise jewelry. What better than selling Indian jewelry to rich Jewish people on the hustle? That was a side hustle when I was 8, marking shit up 1,000%.
Yeah, what were the margins? What were the margins on that? Buy it for 50, sell it for 200.
No one had better candy than Howard as a kid. I was fucking urban candy like crazy. And I mean, that's why I have all fake teeth. I have like one hanging tooth by the time I was 30. No one was monitoring my sugar intake.
What were your candies of choice? Sticky ones. You're a Starburst guy.
I'm a red guy. Skittles? Like, I still don't know, like, as much as I complain about Twitter, why hasn't Sweet Tarts come out with an all red package? I mean, little simple stuff bugs me. Like, I'd be short Sweet Tarts at this point. Now, they came out with Shock Tarts, which is like makes my face go bananas. So I think Shock Tarts are an incredible, you know, premium product. But it took a long time for sour Sweet Tarts to come out. And I still don't want green and yellow ones. That's just like fucking me. Half the package is shit. So there's still a lot of stuff to fix in the candy business, let alone Facebook.
It's kind of like being a venture capitalist, like 300 hitter makes the whole
thing. You put me in charge of Sweet Tarts, I double the size of that company. One call. No office. I don't even need an office. I need a Zoom and the head of Sweet Tarts fix that company.
So Howard, did you
no focus groups? I'm the focus group. Give me red and purple Sweet Tarts and the blue. I'll keep the blue. Three. Fucking yellow and green is ridiculous.
Do you have the same? Do you have the same feelings with other candy colors? You got served something. That's so nice.
Yeah.
Do you want to bring whoever that is?
Papers. I just got papers.
Is your
those are divorce papers?
She's been listening to the podcast. I just got served. Oh, and it's by the company we invested in.
First of all, would your wife like to keep it in the family?
Yeah, it's good. We'll have a good month. Well, somebody will have a good month.
Howard, would your wife like to say hi? And two, love to know what your reading looks like today.
Oh, my reading? I don't read.
Reading no, your papers. Losers.
Oh, what? Sorry. What papers?
I thought you were just delivered your newspapers.
No, that was my wife saying to quiet down.
Okay.
No, I'm kidding. She just dropped something for me. It was a sandwich without crust on it at 12 p.m. exactly the way I like it.
Wow.
She's 4 minutes late. She'll hear about that later.
She is 4 minutes late.
Oh, God.
Oh, man. Just got out of line. All right, so I was an entrepreneur as a kid, a lot of side hustles, and I didn't, you know, there was no entrepreneurship back then. You were Jewish, you were a lawyer, doctor, furrier, or an accountant, and I hated animals, and I did go to law school for about an hour in Arizona.
When did you drop? Did you drop out, like, right away?
Yeah, okay. Switched to the MBA immediately. Law was going to be a lot of work is what I saw. There's a lot of textbooks. And
absolutely.
Yeah, and it was 150 degrees before global warming. It was 160 by the end of college. Now it's 175. We know this, but it was 150 back in the days. And it was a good 150. There was no pools or golf courses. Phoenix was a different place. But I went to ASU, did my MBA, and just wanted to live in Arizona. Loved the sun, loved the desert.
By the way, any profession that gets paid by the hour, like just the simple math is, you just got to work a lot of fucking hours to make a lot of money.
I don't get it. It was a trap. I somehow escaped the trap. I don't know any happy lawyers. I think if my kids wanted to be lawyers, I did a bad job as a parent. I joke about it, but it's true. When you have all these choices.
You guided them away.
What's that?
You guided them away.
If I guided them, I just think they saw the happy-go-lucky career, and whether they think that whether that's dangerous because it's a fantasy, right? You got to work hard. But I think an hourly job is what robots really are coming for, and people mm-hmm. should be focused on, like I said, social leverage and building their networks and traveling and experiencing things and living lean. And you know, they were on that way until COVID. So, like, we'll see what happens. But I got lucky. I got 30 years of travel at, you know, $4 to fly last minute for dinner somewhere. And that just somehow ended. That's how things took it for granted. And this is our punishment. But yeah, my kids are kind of entrepreneurial.
It's great.
And my wife is. She's back working in real estate. She was a bankruptcy attorney, and she's, you know, the kids are out of the house. She's back working.
So your wife's a lawyer.
She was a practicing lawyer. She's a reform lawyer. But again, that was the thing, you know, a lot of Jewish kids, that's what they saw their parents doing. That's how you climb out of post-World War you know, the first immigrants struggle. Second ones don't want to struggle. They get a professional job. And now we haven't had war. By the fourth generation, we just want to live.
Where did you meet your wife?
Just ordered her from a Russian thing just before that was cool. What are the odds? We met on a blind date, which was before Tinder. That's what people did. And that's it. Nothing fancy.
What did the person that set you up with the blind date, were they probably felt that you were, that you needed this, right? That you needed somebody to kind of, you needed guardrails.
I think they obviously didn't
especially
like
after
her.
ASU. Right.
They wanted like her, obviously. They wanted to punish her. No, I mean, that's what you do, right? Like, I don't know, I don't even think I asked. It's just people say, oh, I know somebody for you, you know? And that's how we met. Nothing fancy there.
Howard, your ASU experience, obviously known as one of the best party schools. I mean, did you get through? And do you have any tattoos as a result or any scars from your time
tattoos?
There?
The Jewish part was I did live with some, like, it's so funny because I grew up conservative, but not like, now everything's reformed, which I'm fine with too, is I knew conservatism, right? It's like, don't get a tattoo, marry a Jewish person, don't kick a can if you're in Israel, could be a bomb, things like that, you know, the safety things. And so those were kind of my guiding principles. And so you just were trying to please your parents and carry on the thing. You know, as you get older, you just like, I question religion and all those things that happen in a world that has infinite information. But at the same time, good conservative, I like the conservative side of things. You know, it wasn't broken. It's just the internet just expanded everybody's ability to check shit out.
Yeah. And so Howard, what was your first job out of ASU?
It's a good question. So I wasn't an American, so it's like very stressful. Like, you know, the Iraq war broke out. I was in Thunderbird. The Kuwait situation. Thunderbird is like a great international school in Phoenix that it's like a little school that was known for like international management. And it was like 150 country students in the middle of the desert. And the war broke out and it was just a weird time to be, and then the massive recession in 1990. So it was like nothing going on, right? It was like a war and a recession and like the finance SNL crisis. And I'm in the middle of the SNL crisis in Phoenix, right? A lot of criminal activity and mortgage problems. And I'm like 26. I'm like, I don't know anything about it. And I just open up the newspaper and just start circling jobs, you know? It's overqualified. And I needed someone to like sponsor me because I'm not American. So I took whatever job I could. That became a stockbroker. And I knew nothing about the stock market, but it was like anything to get in. And they sponsored me, a small Dallas firm sponsored me. And I just started making cold calls, right, with two graduate degrees. It wasn't like a good job. It was just like, okay, they thought I would be smart with all those degrees and they were just going to sponsor me.
Yep.
They handed me a phone and
I feel like everyone should have that experience of
cold calls.
Cold calling
your whole life is cold calling.
And getting rejection and moving on to the next one and hearing, you learn so much through that. And if you can accept no's and punishment, you can kind of get pretty tough, I think.
I sold encyclopedias and my dad made me sell Encyclopedias Britannica in high school. So, you know, I learned rejection. I was like, your one job is to get into someone's house. You know, you were begging for the Glengarry leads, right? It would be like some handicapped person scribbling on a note and say, I'll call this person. And I'm like, no, that person's not a lead. But like, so I knew a lot about that, you know, fighting for good leads and like understanding that was your job. Like that was the only way to succeed. I didn't have a rich family to call on. I was living in Phoenix without a green card.
Did you like it? Did you like being a stockbroker? And did you
no
make
one likes cold calling? If you say you like cold calling, you're probably not a normal human being. So as abnormal as I am, I'm normal enough to know that's not a life. Now, it's great lessons. If you're cold calling when you're 50, life sucks. So it's good to know what you don't want. I didn't want to be Dahmer and I didn't want to do cold calling. So I'm like two pretty good choices.
All right, by the way, the list is building up.
There's always a list.
Didn't want to be Howie's bomber, list. Doesn't want to
yeah,
be.
Yeah, I have a list. I carry it around. And this the last thing on the list is don't go back on that super forecaster show, whatever you call this thing, superpower show. Episode two, just turn it down. So it's just so many great lessons. When you cold call, it's just like you don't know what's going to be on the other side. Right? It's like spinning a wheel, right? So the more you spin it, the more shit can happen.
How important is learning rejection, Howard, through that as it relates to your
going down rabbit holes. That's the internet before. It's like someone takes your call, but it could be a psycho that invites you into their house and cuts you up like Dahmer.
Yeah.
And so there was rabbit holes, there was wasted time, there was learning to size people up, and you just learn. Like that was just the meat. There was no mentoring, there was a phone.
So how long did you stay at this job?
Well, I mean, another great question. So no normal people would stay at that job. Now, I should have stayed at that job and I should have, I'd be rich if I was a stockbroker 30 years later, right? I would have screwed all my clients and I'd be rich. So I chose a different way to screw everybody. And so one of my cold calls just was one of the greatest, just a kid, you know, you're dialing rich people. So, yep. I mean, that's the goal. You're not dying of people in poverty. Hey, homeless guy, you ready to do stocks? No, it was like you're trying to size up who rich people were. So I was reading the paper, Phoenix local thing, and I saw this guy, and they were talking about how successful his business was, Mark Scatterday, and I just cold called him. This guy hustled me like he was broke, but, you know, his front page of the paper holding his product called The Grip. This is a stress ball. And went down to pitch him to invest and ended up having to invest in his company. So I borrowed money from my parents. I just walked into this company and I was like, this is the greatest fucking product of all time. And I quit my job like the next day, wrote him a check. And we went on to build probably the fastest, one of the greatest startups for its era, an ad specialty business, very high margin business. We put corporate logos on stress balls and we built this big ad specialty company. And so, you know, it was just kind of a miracle happenstance of a cold call that turned into a great experience. And then I learned the real lessons, like Rodney Dangerfield business lessons. Like we did everything wrong. Like everything. Yeah. I would come out with the textbook. Okay, here's the fire log story. Here's how we got to run the business. And he was just like, nah. And we would just do everything wrong. But we had margins. So the lesson of that first company was like, you make a lot of mistakes if you have high margins.
Yeah.
And it's hard to find businesses with high margins. So
what happened to the corporate stress ball business? And what was it called?
It was called The Grip, GRIPP.
Yep.
And it became like, we got it on QVC. It's still in the Hall of Fame of QVC. You know, we put three in a package, soft, medium, and firm, and old ladies like squeezing balls. That was kind of the thing, you know? It was like carpal tunnel. It was like QVC was like the internet. QVC was the warm-up to the internet, right? That was when the internet was just phone banks of people dialing and buying shit. It was Shopify and Amazon in Philadelphia.
How do you think that would go over on Shark Tank?
That was what led to the internet.
Howard, how do you think that would go on Shark Tank today, pitching that idea?
Would have been a home run. Everybody's, it was just a magical product at a magical time, with magical margins, a fucking monkey could have read it, and I was that monkey.
But here's what's missing.
So did you sell the business, or you just made a lot of money?
Well, I didn't own the business, right? So we all skimmed and crushed it, you know, out of cash flow. But my partner was spending it faster than he could make it. We were buying cars. He's hilarious, this guy. I mean, he was a college dropout, Mark, and he just didn't have money. And we were like drug dealers, you know. We'd be smoking cigars in the warehouse. We had like all these like, I wouldn't say illegals, but they were illegal. People with small, you had to have small hands to make the squeeze ball, right? It was four tension wrap latex. We were the largest Siberian millet order like customer in the world.
Would you interview people based on size of hand? I mean,
we'd go to this little church that was like,
oh my God.
Korean women.
Are these too big?
No, Trump size hands. We needed Trump size hands, but on women's bodies. So his hands come a lot on women's bodies. And so we would take a picture of, you know, Trump and just, you know, and say, do you have hands like this? And so we were making millions of these things. And the greatest thing about this, because it's like free software, right? Like act software, which was our contact management. It was like the greatest thing that, you know, it was Palm Pilot days. So it was like our business was run on ACK Content Management, which was probably the first billion-dollar software company, right? Because that's how it was at CRM. Salesforce before Salesforce. So you know, back then it was paper until ACT. So we just had the right place, right time, pre-internet. It was the kind of product that corporations wanted their logo on, and it was just like a magical product. Sold at retail, sold at wholesale, sold at ad specialty, and everybody, and the margins were crazy, and we would get paid before we shipped the product. So we were like buying Ferraris at lunch and just doing stupid stuff. Right. And practical jokes and
everything the founder shouldn't do.
Here's like the part 23 years old. He was like 23 years old. And we were doing like $4 or $5 million a month and like 90% margins.
You know when they have this one reminds me, Howard, you know like when you're a kid, the prison guys come to school, I think it's called Scared Straight. Mm-hmm. And like they basically scare young teens of like not stealing shit. You should go on a road. This your future is to visit schools across the country and literally tell your fucked up founder stories. And you will literally, I think the 90, 85, 90% failure rate in startup, those numbers will decline if you visit more people. Have you thought about that?
I do. Startups would do much better if they really understood cap table and choosing their partners and slowing down and speeding up. It's part race, part marathon, right? Like, just like life, part race, part marathon, right? And, you know, I'm just blessed that I have this context. I can be having a bad day and see a handicapped person and just feel bad. Like, and just go, fuck it. Like, you know, my day's better. You can't tell people to feel like that. That's one of my superpowers. Like, I have context for how.
Oh no, Howard, never do that again. Ever do that again. This show will never air if you say this is my superpower. Because that's don't ever do that again.
Listen, okay? We only have one rule at the Superpowers podcast, which is don't talk about your superpower.
Howard, I never said that word until you named the show. Howard, though, so don't worry.
Howard, I got one thing that's kind of burning. I need the now. Where?
So I was just saying, like, I'm just lucky that I'm wired to like have context for those things. Not everybody does. Like,
Howard, where's the part of your journey of you trying stand up comedy and being a comedian in that part of your career? There had to have been a trial run at this.
Oh yeah, yeah. So I'm saying I was inspired by it, and then when I was 16, you know, my friends thought I was funny. Your mom thinks you're funny. You're doing all this stuff, watching Johnny Carson, like I had that was my life. Couldn't, you know, my parents let me stay up late to watch Johnny Carson, you know, and I would polish my shoes and put my knickers in the corner and get my pipe and have a scotch and watch Johnny Carson and these drunks fucking just have hilarious time on TV smoking. That was my
at the
fantasy.
Age of 16 was your first 14, scotch 16?
12. I was watching Johnny Carson thinking I should be smoking a pipe. And wearing a cape and like a cane, and like Dean Martin was hammered, and Ruth Buzzy was crazy, and Carol Burnett was hysterical, and dude, that was just I had the fucking bug of just laughing, and it was the way that I got along with people too, right? So obviously being funny got me things. So that was just that was my little trick, is like, all right, get out of a situation by saying, making fun of myself, whatever it took to get out of a situation.
Yeah.
And you quickly learn that, which is why certain people bug me, is including the president right now, is like, all you have to do is be willing to laugh at yourself and you're going to be able to get 10 times further ahead. And how simple a trick is that? Make fun of your own nose. I mean, no one's going to hate you for that, right? But you're going to disarm a lot of people, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm just lucky that was my trick. And plus I had a big nose. And I, you know, but
you,
it just
Howard,
made my life easier.
Howard, for our guest, can you for? Yep, yeah, that's a good snog. That's good.
And my head was much smaller then. The I had a good mop of hair. So I finally got the courage to go up on stage, and I fucking killed it. Like my first time, biggest problem. It's like having a stock trade go your way. So I just crushed it, and. That just got me hooked in that weird lifestyle of going every night to do open mics in Toronto. And it was just started working my way up. It's not a good thing, you know, back then. And because it's just a really weird people, including myself, and weird culture and everybody stealing jokes. And it's just a, you know, unprofessional setting for a 15-year-old and a 14-year-old. And these people like Jim Carrey, you would just, you can't be funny when you're 14. These guys were funny. Not just to me, but like they could do any impersonation. And for Mike Myers could do 100 things. And so I was watching legends. You just knew it. You don't follow their career, but they're like, oh yeah, that was obvious. Once Jim Carrey was like Ace Ventura and all those things, you know? So they were famous already in Toronto, as was, you know, we grew up, Eugene Levy.
I didn't realize Jim Carrey was.
Of course he was.
Yeah, okay.
So those were my idols. So of course I went down comedy, and then I just started bombing, and you know, that wasn't the life that I wanted. But I was always good at writing for other comics, but there's no money in that when you're 15. You were just say, hey, try this out. And I was great at fixing things. And so that's why I think writing is my gift, or not my gift, the thing I love doing the most. Even though I hated school and reading and doing essays, you know, now I have my blog and that's my passion, is just writing and sharing.
Howard, go ahead, Bill.
Now you do the stress ball thing. You see that, you learn, you know, the beauty of having, you know, high margins, good margins basically hide everything wrong with the operations.
Yes.
And so what's next?
What's next is just a shit pile of mistakes from that, you know, which makes me say, like, school's stupid. Like, no matter how much schooling you have, you might as well get your ass kicked out there on the streets. But, you know, what led to is we had so much money for that time. We were just managing our money. So, you know, I got into the stock market again, not from the brokerage side. I knew how to treat brokers because that's how people treated me. So I just hired a bunch of brokers. And so we were just trading at lunch. And the 90s were like a boom, semiconductors and everything. It's like today, like with digital stocks, everything went up. So, you know, you start thinking you're smart. I had no experience managing money, but I just thought that's what Jewish people did if they weren't a lawyer or an accountant. And so I started a hedge fund in 08, and with his money and my money and friends that thought I was smart. And just, that was my next long time.
Yep.
And that is not a normal life. And which led me to the opposite of that life, which is thinking longer term and doing angel investing. So I kind of finally got lucky and figured that part of the world out.
Howard, let's accelerate into that. At that time frame, I remember I'm sure you did deals before that. I know you're in Buddy Media, but let's get into the, and Michael Lazaro's great exit. Let's get into that. How did you get into angel investing and kind of build in that reputation and that brand where people would take your money, and some companies that you invested in, founders, and let's talk a little bit about that, because that also evolved into you being a founder. I may have my timeline off a little bit, but talk a little bit about that and stock twits.
Well, I mean, back before the internet, or the internet was coming out, a hedge fund was like a startup, right? You eat what you kill, you skim a little, but you're taking 20% of the profits. That's a business. Yeah. And you can cheat, I guess, which is hedge funds are known for, obviously, but you're trying to beat the index, you know, and what a stupid race that is. That's no different than dogs chasing a bunny around a dog track, right? Like dumbest thing, right? Like what a loser life that I was living considering all the freedom I had. But you don't know that. You think you're smart, and that's what the markets trick you into, these things. That's the market's trick. I suck you in. So I was an entrepreneur, just didn't know what kind of entrepreneur. And so the markets crashed in 2001. And, you know, by 99, I was doing internet deals like any other idiot, you know, Series Q and Series Z, Series Double B. And I made some really dumb investments. And just one of them turned out to be a great one. Through the crash, and I got the bug, and I was like, you know, became friends with that founder, and I was living in Phoenix, and started stumbling upon startups, and I had a pretty good eye for picking winners, and you know, the first big one.
Expand on that a little bit. What was that? What were you? Was it the founder? Was it like how did you evaluate a startup?
You did. You were, I mean, the first ones were like, hey, these things double in a day, no different than today. It was just that simple. You know, Mary Meeker or Henry Blodgett or the analyst of the day would just say, this is going to double, and they doubled. You know, there was no internet. It was just, you had a pulpit, and whatever that person spoke, it was like, you know, distribution scam. But there was a very narrow funnel of information, and you just had to position yourself in that funnel. Then the internet happened, and all that came undone, and then rebuilt in a more distributed way with the social web. And maybe the next wave will be decentralized. You know, we'll see. Like, it's just that part of the bundling and unbundling of things. But I got out of being in the rat race of trying to beat the index, and Vanguard kind of killed that index, for better or for worse. Yep. I think it was for better at first. Now it's for worse. And we're seeing the unbundling with Robinhood. But so the cycle's everywhere. But I just was fascinated with, like, my financial industry and how stupid it was, and CNBC and Wall Street Journal and Bloomberg. And I was like so mad all the time of like just getting screwed and like being, and so my whole life became about, like, if I was in charge, I would build this product. And, you know, so it was really just my own nitpicks of things. You know, I was using Yahoo Finance and crappy software, and just so my own stumbling and bumbling and living my own better life just led me to passionately, in my heart, have domain experience and know what I wanted to fix.
Howard, when you tweet, you get about, you know, 20 retweets and 100 likes just by saying good morning. When I tweet, I get like two. One of them, though, I thought was pretty good, which was, because I like my own stuff, is the best ideas generally come out of sort of ashes and pain or frustration. And it sounds like, as far as stock tweets and some of the things you were doing, you just saw
just scratching my own itch. Scratching my own itch, high passion, easy to convince other people that I had domain experience. Same things we look for in founders, you know. Money has become a commodity. So, like, if you think I can save your business with $100K or $1 million check, we're all screwed. Meaning, everybody's got a purpose in building this thing. And that's where we've evolved to now. And this, after this COVID crisis, is like, okay, why are you an investor? You know, every piece to a puzzle is important, from the cap table to your first investor to your board. And companies are just being built smarter. Mistakes along the way, little bubbles along the way. SoftBank was a bubble. 3D printing was a bit of a bubble. There's been all kinds of mini bubbles, right? Like, where money gets misallocated. And I see the biggest bubble right now is Vanguard, right? And we're seeing Robinhood now unwinding that. You know, the biggest bubble was, oh, I'll put my money in S&P 500, and every American will hold hands and own the same 500 stocks. And all in the sake of saving money. Well, what happens, like, in March when every fucking person's down 60% on their money and looking at each other, and no one's thought through, you know, why should I own the same stocks as everybody else?
Yeah.
And so finance is just the way I think of the world, and I'm, you know, I'm stuck, you know, and I just keep banging away.
Tell everyone what is StockTwits. I think that's around the time I met you, and we were both part of the True Ventures founder class, but talk to us a little bit. You were definitely the oldest founder there, but talk to us a little bit about the StockTwits journey. What was StockTwits?
StockTwits is just another itch. I had sold my last company to CBS, Wallstrip, and Wallstrip was like my first idea, YouTube, CNBC on YouTube, but it got bought so fast that, you know, I was working at CBS and I saw Twitter come along and I was like blown away. And back then Twitter was on a BlackBerry. And I just remember texting Fred. I was like, people should be talking about stocks on Twitter. And Fred was like, that's genius. And I sent him my email, you know, $BBRY, which was BlackBerry. And he just sent me back a BlackBerry that said, that's genius. And I kind of got sucked into like starting the company. You know, I gave the idea to Twitter, obviously, but they were just like, kumbaya, and, you know, we're going to save the world. And I'm like, nah, you should be Bloomberg. And so I kind of sucked myself into starting that company and raised a lot of money, or not enough money, or whatever you want to call it, and started StockTwits.
And then you ran it? Yeah, go ahead, Bill.
What happened with the business?
I'm wearing a hat, not a cape. So it's going okay. I haven't got the hair replacements yet. So we're just surviving.
Yeah. So you still run the business today?
No, God. I never ran it even though I was CEO. I don't know what I was doing. I started it. We've had our ups and downs, always grown, but just, you know, not a, a major social network, but just a unique social network. And, you know, as I've learned, patients and networks really do matter. And we're having our best year ever, you know, 12 years later, growing faster than ever. And can't predict, you know, COVID and no sports and Robin Hood and everything else and Twitter's mistakes and our things we did well. And the original idea is still a good idea. People love hanging out and talking about stocks all day long. Fred had the great tagline for it. It was like, hey, if you like stocks and like talking about them all day long, Stock Twits is for you. And I was like, dude, that's too narrow. But like, no,
so simple.
That was always the best fucking tagline. And I was always hating, like, you know, more than that. No. And there's nothing wrong. It turns out there's millions of people that like Davey Burstool, like talking about stocks. They just don't know as much as you, and they may be making mistakes, but it's just, they're all just trying to make a buck. And so we're kind of like this goofy, irreverent mentor network and social network, but it's Twitter for stocks with just a lot more features.
Yeah.
And a lot of the same problems, but we think about it from everything that Twitter should do, but for stocks.
Yep.
So Howard, just shifting gears into, so how many angel investments have you made over the years, money deployed, some things you're proud of, and then are you still doing that? And then tell our audience a little bit about what you're doing today with your venture fund and the focus. And what made you decide to do that? Like why do a venture fund versus just, you know,
Did a venture fund just because we just, that's the way the world slowly, you know, we tried every different thing, the BetaWorks model, the incubation model, the writing our own checks model, the single purpose vehicle model, all the things that like maybe better or worse than a simple 2 and 20 or 2.5 and 20 fund. It's just time in life, aggravation of single purpose vehicles, you know, accounting, all the different things that just started trusts, started lining up as like to raise money. But, you know, probably over 100 companies, a lot of them, you know, 25, 10 to 50K investments. We still do that type of stuff, but, you know, very fund focused first. You know, if it doesn't fit in the fund and we really love the founder, maybe we'll do a personal check. But generally, it's, you know, 100% on social leverage. I focus on financial services. Gary focuses on enterprise. He sold his company to Salesforce, also a true company. Tom, my partner forever, he does all the, does real estate and runs the firm. And then we just brought on a fourth partner, Ross Hoffman, who was at Ren Headspace. And before that was Twitter under Adam Bain running sales and growth. And before that at YouTube. So it's like four of us, no staff. This current fund's 45 million, probably out raising fund four really soon. Great returns, you know. Great returns, at least people say they're great returns. I don't know. Like, again, I don't measure against anything. Our investors are happy. And, you know, we're proud of, you know, sticking, being, you know, I guess founder friendly, but we're, you know, we work for our LPs. So we're proud of returning capital to our, we're proud that we didn't have to steal money or skim. You know, it's a good lifestyle and our investors seem to be getting their capital back and love the companies that we invest in. And so we've built this beautiful, like, win-win-win for now scenario where you can have a win-win-win. You know, the founders are happy, we're happy. A lot of failure in our industry, but the founders are happy, we're happy, and the LPs are happy. You know, why switch it up? Pinch me.
Right. And you have your baby Stock Twits running.
What's that? Stock Twits is still successful.
Yeah. Well, so.
And most importantly, my kids like are like not a pain in the ass. They seem relatively happy.
Let's talk about them a little bit. I see a lot of picks. You play golf with them. I think I may have met one of your sons in New York. It seems like you're also enjoying that that time with them as well, right? You have
your, you have to because there you go through phases where they don't enjoy you. So
true.
As a 54-year-old, I try and impart that on people. It's like, you have your time with them. You can screw it up. You do screw it up, but like then they don't want to spend time with you and you can't change all that. Cats in the Cradle or whatever the hell that song is.
That's a sad, that's a sad song. Let's not talk about Steve.
No, but you know, but it mostly is sad because you don't appreciate the time you have and then they go do their own thing. But yeah, my kids, you know, you try and create a house where they're happy to come when they want and try not to judge. And you try and push them in a direction and you try and make sure that they understand that like it's not easy and that they should be nice and they should get their meds right. Oh, wait, did I say that?
What?
And, you know, where the local dispensary is, and should they have a medical marijuana card, all the little things that matter in raising children.
Right. Where the true parenting comes from. Howard,
how do you break up your day? Like, how do you figure out what you're going to prioritize? Cause like that, I feel like, you know, I'm an operator. I do a lot of angel investing, but I was like, if I did angel investing full time, I think I might be I'd become an alcoholic. And maybe even a drug addict.
So it's the question, right? So that's why the name of our firm. So what fascinated me about what I hated about Wall Street and still do in CNBC is this like expert. There's one guy who talks. And so like Vanguard's now the expert. The guy Bogle had a great idea. We were getting hosed, right? And that's a great idea. It's become the problem, right? Just because it's cheap doesn't mean it's good product. Okay, yep. So that's America, you know, with everything. Everything's frail. We've seen that with April. You know, we think we're doing so great, but it's a frail back. It's just a lot of frailty, fragility, whatever Taleb calls it, but I call it frailty.
If it was a good one, it was mine.
Bill. So financial with this country was so fragile around this stupid idea of lever things up, right? Like take my building, sell it 10 times, package it this way, dump it on the next guy, don't worry about it. And it's called financial leverage. And we have the perfect storm. Building. Everybody was like, push it aside, repackage it. That's financial leverage. That ended in 2008. That was the story. And so I was discovering social media and I had said the idea, and so financial leverage is a tactic, not a strategy. Yeah. That became, that's what you got to do. Package, bundle, who cares? Leave the mess for the next guy because it works. Yep. There was no internet. There was no software. And then Twitter comes along and Facebook. And I'm like, no, the real leverage, the smart leverage is social leverage. Meaning, just what you said, Bill, the real problem is time. So if you can manage your time, it's infinite. If you can manage your time properly and not stress out, you know, no one can manage their time perfectly, but time is infinite, time isn't infinite, the cloud and whatever is infinite. And that's the trick, right? The devil in that is like, now that you have all this time, how are you going to spend it? But if you do social leverage properly, it's fucking infinite possibilities, right? From a podcast here to a network there to a relationship here, it's just, you can go as fast as you want, but time is what you got to manage. And that's what the kids are stressing about is they have infinite time. It's like, you know, when your son calls you and says, Dad, I've run out of stuff to watch on Netflix. That's a different problem than, hey, you know, the racists are bothering me at school. So these kids just have different problems. It's not their fault that they have endless time and endless choice and endless curate. You know, they have their problem is cure. How do they spend their time? And we're telling them to spend their time 4 years in school. Well, we just saw the end of that. Schools are stupid.
Yeah.
Google is totally. Google. Why when they can look this shit up and go learn on the job on the first day, as Rodney Dangerfield would say, that's what kids should be doing.
Yep.
You know, so we're screwing the kids up by like putting them on some weird path that worked maybe 40 years ago. And
so where did your kids go to school?
U of A. My son did drop out. He hated school.
Yeah.
So he sensed it, right? Because this year was a disaster for everybody else. and he's actually going to second generation Stocktwits person. He's going to go start in customer support there. But I think the key thing is about you said, Bill, is like time is your thing.
Yeah.
And with software and the internet, we've been gifted this time. And maybe Andrew Yang is right. Maybe we should be giving people money because if we can help just 10% of the people not feel helpless, that's great.
Yeah.
Maybe 90% will become the 90% that we're going to be shit anyways, stay shit or become bums, but at least we could save 10%, you know? So I don't know, like anything's up in the air to me at this point.
Yeah. I do like the idea around social leverage.
Now you at least know why I call it that. There's
a reason. Yeah.
Howard, Would you rethink school and pushing universities and all that on your kids if they were, I don't know, 5 and 7 today going into this post-COVID? And I mean, let's assume that you're a kind of normal person, you're going to have debt. They're going there to kind of party a little bit. Now you have social distancing to think about. A lot of them don't come out and go into this promised land. I mean, would you rethink that, or maybe encourage them to go another path or be more smarter? Or I really asking, not put the pressure like most parents do that they have to get that degree.
I think give me the choice now. I'd say it's better the kid owes Best Buy $80,000 than his college, because he's going to pay back Best Buy and he's going to be pissed off at. I'd rather be pissed off at Best Buy for ripping him off than college, because at least we've got a flat screen and a fucking, you know, bong holder or whatever the hell they're going to get at Best Buy these days. But that's what drove us. I was the consumer generation. You owed Best Buy and you had to pay Best Buy. You couldn't get a fucking car. And if you couldn't get a car, you couldn't get a house. And if you couldn't get a house, you couldn't get a wife. If you can't get a wife, you can't have kids. So the narrative was different then, right? You go to school and it was like your first day of school, there was Amex, Capital One. They were fucking waiting for you like vultures. Yeah. Now everybody's Venmoing each other and like fucking flipping off the Capital Ones of the world. So, and instead the scam is school. So I don't think any parent should run up $100,000 in debt, or any kid to go to school.
Yeah. Yep.
They should be building their network in high school and figuring out what they want to do. And maybe just, since no one checks resumes anyways, even at the presidential level, maybe it's okay to not go to school. Like, who checked his resume? Right? Like, I mean, we saw, even if he lied, we all knew he was a knucklehead.
Yeah.
So my knucklehead kids are way better than that guy. So they could be anything. So I don't know. I mean, school's great for some kids.
So what do you look for when, you know, some kid, you know, some 24-year-old kid has a great fucking idea. They come and pitch you. Like, what do you look for? Like, you know, so many people, you know, like, you know, and actually the bigger you get, the more political you become, and you got to put a deck, you know, pitch deck. Blah, blah, blah. Like, I fucking hate pitch decks. I want to know what your idea is. It has to be something around passion. Sure. And I got to see the fire in your eye. What do you look for?
Well, I'm older, so it's like, I'm not inviting people to pitch me unless we think it's interesting, right? So we're better at like screening that stuff. Like, and my inbox is just, this is not a brag at all. It's just a problem of the industry is, you know, how do you curate and how do you filter, right?
Yeah.
It's information overload. We all face it. I'm publicly pushing to get deals. So it's like, it's my fault for creating this in the first place. It's a whole new problem. But we're trying to just be honest. It's like, okay, you know, you put the vibe out there like dating. It's like, if the next Robin Hood's out there, please call me. You know, because our big risk is not seeing the next Robin Hood or the next LifeLock or the next Buddy Media. So we're trying to put out the vibe of what we're looking for by writing and tweeting and doing all the goof. It's like sex, right? You're just kind of mating out there and social, and you're trying to attract the right people. So you're putting the vibe out there and you're trying to find great founders who have, I think domain experience really matters. So I'm going to back people, guys like me, who just like fucking have a problem with the world and it may be weird and it may just be small, but if they can solve good problems and they know their space and they know what's driving them nuts, that's about all I could do.
Yep.
In a world where money is commodity, interest rates are zero and they're printing it and handing it out in the streets by helicopter. Why would I waste my time on just trying to make money? I just want to do stuff that kind of, I feel like I could chip in a little bit, and God forbid to run the company, I'll run it. But why would I invest in something I have no interest in? So biotech, hardware.
Yeah.
What am I going to do? I had no value.
Yep. Agreed.
We're finally at this place where money shouldn't matter for rich people. Therefore they should focus on things that they're good at and can help things go faster.
Yep.
And the biotech people should do biotech, and the science people should do science, and you know, and project the stuff out there and herd people in, and everybody should be a little more honest with themselves and get on their path a lot sooner. If people can be put on their path a lot sooner, they'd be a lot happier people.
Yeah. Amen to that. Amen to that.
Baby.
And now, with the $45 million fund, are you
Yes, you can invest. Well, just I'll send you a DocuSign.
Let me send you. I'm gonna actually.
You're in. Oh, by the way, we just had an exit. You just doubled your money.
Done. Uh-huh. Done. I'm gonna fly the helicopter myself and drop the money on your house. Do you reserve you do an angel in Robin Hood and you're like, holy fuck, this could be like a massive company. Do you then participate in future, Series A, Series B?
Now we're big enough. Then we had a scramble to do the A. It was a great story. I just knew, a lot of times I don't know what I'm doing. That one, they walked into my office and I was like, StockTwits Twitter, this needs to be built. Beautiful UI. They just nailed it. Maybe they didn't think they nailed it, but I did. And so we backed up the truck with 100K.
Literally.
Yeah. Backed it up, called mom and said, mom, listen, put down your liquor, put on the fur coat. Daddy's got one for you. So we put in 100K. I think it was an 8 million bal. And then the funny story there is that our fund was like $6 million. So like 200K, and then you follow on with 100K. So we had room for follow-ons. And then for the A round, Baijiu and Blau, really sophisticated young guys, and they were always good at optimizing for cap table. And they knew I was horny for Robinhood. I just knew that was the one. And I had seen enough winners to know, back the truck up when you really believe. And I remember calling Fred Wilson. I'm like, Fred, what do I do? The valuation's going to be stupid, but I got to go lead this deal. And I don't have the money. He goes, just write the term sheet, idiot. And so we wrote up a term sheet, 10 or 11 million, 11 million on a 60 million. We just made it up. And Index beat us. They shopped it probably, and Index beat us. And who the hell's Social Leverage? Who's Clarence Beeks? But by being aggressive, we bought our way into that round at some level. Scrambled. We didn't have 11 million. They knew that. We knew that. We would have raised it somehow.
Yep.
But Index could write a check much faster than us, and that wouldn't bounce necessarily. And they got the deal. He's in the Jan is now a Midas investor, and I'm doing podcasts. Is that some of
everyone
that
has a yeah, everyone
but
has
you're
a
much
story.
Happier. You're much happier though.
Hey,
oh, please.
Hey,
I'd rather be on.
Howard,
go to yourself. He's got planes
Howard,
and automobiles. I got fucking some dude in the back with a knapsack on.
And a good hat. Howard, one more question from me before we kind of get this wrapped is with your ability to manage time, and the name of your firm clearly sort of expresses your understanding of social leverage and time management. What are the things that you're not doing today that you want to do? What are the projects that we should expect to hear from Howard in the future? What are you drumming up since you've mastered the clock so well?
I would say it depends who you ask if I've mastered the clock. I think I've mastered the ability to do what I want to do. So some people would call that selfish and unproductive. Well, everybody would, but fuck them. But Bill likes me, and that's all that matters.
Yeah.
Because I doubled his money in 3 seconds.
Yeah.
Whore that he is. What was the question?
What's next, man? What are the projects you got?
What's next is this. I'm so super fucking bullish on like conversations and fucking speeding people's learning curve up, whether you call it Khan Academy or whatever you call this harebrained idea, you're a super forecaster. Nose picker.
We're the super forecast.
Nose pickers.
Supercalifragilistic.
Yeah. So whatever we call this, I think good conversation with smart people, smiles, helping other people speed up, paying it forward, projecting the vibe to meet other smart people, getting shit done, keep the ego as checked as possible in a world where everybody's like telling you you're great. I like content, right? Like, I don't think it's a good business. Barstool Day is kind of inspiring. It wasn't 2 years ago. It was like Huffington Post and fucking BuzzFeed. Talk about algorithmic crap.
Yeah.
Now everybody's complaining about BuzzFeed and the guy's just fucking funny. So, more.
And
Jim
by the
Carrey
way, he's just recording himself buying stocks.
It's what I predicted. except I'm not an investor in Barstool. So I'm quite inspired by people that back into things, right? Like I always knew CNBC would be disrupted. I didn't know the guy who's because sports was shut down, right? But I knew it was coming. Right. I just got the timing wrong. And now that that's out of the bag, oh, baby, I'm so bullish. So, I mean, like, it's torn because, you know, I have hair coming out of my ears and my toes hurt. And as you know, I have a big nose. And then I got to, like, I'm inspired to do some other things. And the choice is my time, right? Like, I've never been more inspired. And everybody's rooting me on. And I'm like, well, my heart's not in it. But yet, kind of want to do it. And there's no half-ass. So I'm trying to inspire other people to pick up the torch and like do shit that I can back that's that's more Barstool, more disruption of Vanguard, speeding up the disruption, giving people choices, educating them about investing, the power of investing in social leverage and the power of networking and the power of being nice and the power of, you know, being optimistic and choosing, making good choices, you know, because I make good choices and bad choices. You know, I probably could have saved 20 years if I made better choices. Because all I say now is I wish I was 40. So if I can save people 14 years, fuck, I think if I save two people, they're going to love me.
Yep. That's true. So, and you know Bill already loves you.
Bill's a genius.
Yeah.
Well, Howard, we've heard a lot of fun ground today, man. And it's been...
if you tell me the sound didn't work, this is fucked.
Yeah.
Well, we're definitely gonna have to re-record, but this first cut was really good. Listen, out of all the shows we've done, you're easily kind of in the mid, kind of at least the mid tier, and we really appreciate being.
That's a win. That's a win if you've done 7,000 shows. If you've done two, you know, what does that mean?
Yeah.
In the venture world, you know, 50% success rate means like you're Midas. You know,
The fact that you guys had to ask me things that you'd really run out of ideas this early in your series.
This is one of the best average shows we've done. I'm going to kick it to Bill to round up our summary of Howard's superpowers and take it away, Bill. Let's do this.
Well, you know, it's funny. I made this reference earlier that I felt like I was stuck in the middle of like a Seinfeld episode. We might have spoken for 3 hours. I don't know. We talked a lot about a lot of things and a lot about nothing.
Made my day.
Exactly. So you listen, I think you had me at hello.
Yeah, you had me at hello. I have no pants on right now, Bill. I'm yours. I didn't have pants on at the beginning of the episode.
Listen, I doubled my money in the middle of this podcast. So for me, I just want to keep this fucking thing going. I'm thinking triple, quadruple, you know.
Basically, I got a hat on and some Stance socks. That's all that's between you
that's
and me.
That's all you need.
That's the only thing. And
the only thing standing between you and me and some gabardine pants. That's it. That's it.
But listen, I think, you know, an awkward kid, Jewish kid from Toronto, you know, he avoided going down the Jeffrey Dahmer route. Certainly, I think, you know, I do believe life is not a sprint. It's not a marathon. I also think life is kind of like a relay race. And you need to know at what point to pass the baton on, you know, and that's running companies. It's in life. And, you said the word empathy earlier today. And, like, I think just, like, today – having social awareness and social intelligence is fucking everything. And, you know, like also having humility, understand who you are, your strengths, your weaknesses, your big nose, your cute ass. And I think more than any other guest we've ever had on, I think your superpower is you have that understanding of who you are and social intelligence is your superpower.
Hey, Bill, Howard, you're not allowed to talk yet. So, Bill, this is the first time, literally word for word, we're like on point. Maybe we need to do more shows. So, Howard, give me one second.
What Chris is saying there is he couldn't think of something more intelligent than what I
said.
No. So he's just agreeing.
I have it right here. Look, I always take a little
note. It goes
here.
To his point. Everybody says he's a bad listener.
So here, I'm going to start with my fun superpowers. One, your superpower as I in 1 hour, the amount of times we've asked you questions and you didn't answer them was incredible. I've never met anyone in my life.
I ran the Adderall wore off like 20 minutes.
You did not answer maybe one question out of 30.
That's all on Ritalin.
Number two, your ability to keep a straight face through almost everything, 99% of the show. Number three, your superpowers, you've been lucky. Okay, now shifting into the summary part where Bill did a very great job. People like you, you're likable, you don't take yourself seriously, EQ, IQ all day. But to Bill's point, especially today, I think your superpower is basic to the core. You're nice and you're kind. And mm-hmm. I think those are literally-
I thought you were a dick, but-
Yeah,
I want my kids
do.
To know. So there we go. But I do think that your inability not to answer questions is the real one. But hey, that Howard.
That is why I just got served by the attorneys of Schmendrick and Schmendrick.
Howard, this was a lot of fun.
Listen, I appreciate Howard taking time out of his busy day. He's leading up the California effort to get Trump reelected. And it was just so good of him to take a few hours out of his day to not
whatever
be
I can
out
do.
There.
Love you orange. Know? Love the color orange. Meanwhile, I've always been a grapefruit guy, which is probably why. I mean, who the fuck would drink an orange when there's grapefruits out there? You know? So this is my whole thing with orange.
Now, this
I
has
like
been
yellow. I like yellow.
Yeah. Listen, I think you were onto something, you know, on eliminating, like in this day and age where everything is about user choice, why can't you just get all of the fucking pink and red Starburst?
Maddening.
You know,
makes no sense.
That was the best idea you had of the whole. I could have stopped the podcast right there.
By the way, I peaked at 12 when I had the idea. Wow. Everything I've done since then has been a fucking offshoot disaster. Of like my perfect idea. Who doesn't want red sweet tarts? Like, let's do it. I've looked at the package. I've emailed the people. It's a PO box. No one fucking, they have no Twitter account. It's fucking bullshit.
You know, well, listen, once our audience gets to this, consider it done.
Yeah, it's the Twitter of candy. Sweet tarts are the Twitter of candy. It's incomplete.
We're gonna solve this for you, my friend. Bill, thanks for the time as well. Howard, great to have you. And good luck with the campaigning out there, brother. And put your pants on soon.
See you guys.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Superpowers.